came in and stood in the door.
Did you find anything on any of those vehicles yet?
Sheriff, I found out everything there was to find. Those vehicles are titled and registered to deceased people. The owner of that Blazer died 20 years ago. Did you want me to see what I could find out about the Mexican ones?
No, Lord, no. Here's your checks.
She came in and took the big leatherette checkbook off his desk and put it under her arm.
That DEA agent called again. You don't want to talk to him?
I'm going to try and keep from it as much as I can.
He said he's going back out there, and he wanted to know if you wanted to go with him.
Well, that's cordial of him. I guess he can go wherever he wants. He's a certified agent of the United States government.
He wanted to know what you were going to do with the vehicles.
Yeah, I've got to try and sell them things at auction. More county money down the toilet. One of 'em's got a hot engine in it. We might be able to get a few dollars for that. No word from Mrs. Moss?
No, sir.
All right.
He looked at the clock on the outer office wall.
I wonder if I could get you to call Loretta and tell her I've gone to Eagle Pass and I'll call her from down there. I'd call her, but she'll want me to come home, and I just might.
You want me to wait till you've quit the building?
Yes, I do.
He pushed the chair back and rose and got down his gun belt from the coat rack behind his desk and hung it over his shoulder and picked up his hat and put it on.
What is it that Torbert says about truth and justice?
We dedicate ourselves anew daily. Something like that.
I think I'm going to commence dedicating myself twice daily. It may come to 3 before it's over. I'll see you in the morning.
He stopped at the cafe and got a coffee to go and walked out to the cruiser as the flatbed was coming up the street, powdered over with the gray desert dust. He stopped and watched it, and then got in the cruiser and wheeled around and drove past the truck and pulled it over. When he got out and walked back, the driver was sitting at the wheel, chewing gum and watching him with a sort of good-natured arrogance. Bell put one hand on the cab and looked in at the driver. The driver nodded.
Sheriff,
he said.
Have you looked at your load lately?
The driver looked in the mirror.
What's the problem, Sheriff?
Bell stepped back from the truck.
Step out here, he said.
The man opened the door and got out. Bell nodded toward the bed of the truck.
That's a damned outrage, he said.
The man walked back and took a look.
One of the tie-downs is worked loose, he said.
He got hold of the loose corner of the tarp and pulled it back up along the bed of the truck, over the bodies lying there, each wrapped in blue reinforced plastic sheeting and bound with tape. There were 8 of them, and they looked like just that. Dead bodies wrapped and taped.
How many did you leave with? Bell said.
I ain't lost none of 'em, Sheriff.
Couldn't you all have took a van out there?
Well, we didn't have no van with 4-wheel drive.
He tied down the corner of the tarp and stood.
All right, Bell said.
You ain't going to write me up for improperly secured load.
You get your ass out of here.
He reached the Devil's River Bridge at sundown, and halfway across he pulled the cruiser to a halt and turned on the roof lights and got out and shut the door and walked around in front of the vehicle and stood leaning on the aluminum pipe that served for the top guardrail. Watching the sun set into the blue reservoir beyond the railroad bridge to the west. A westbound semi coming around the long curve of the span downshifted when the lights came into view. The driver leaned from the window as he passed.
Don't jump, Sheriff. She ain't worth it.
Then he was gone in a long suck of wind, the diesel engine winding up and the driver double-clutching and shifting gears. Bell smiled.
Truth of the matter is, he said, she is.
Some 2 miles past the junction of 481 and 57, the box sitting in the passenger seat gave off a single bleep and went silent again. Shiger pulled onto the shoulder and stopped. He picked up the box and turned it back. He adjusted the knobs. Nothing. He pulled out onto the highway again, The sun pooled in the low blue hills before him, bleeding slowly away, a cool and shadowed twilight falling over the desert. He took off his sunglasses and put them in the glove box and closed the glove box door and turned on the headlights. As he did so, the box began to beep with a slow, measured time. He parked behind the hotel and got out and came limping around the truck with the box and the shotgun and the pistol all in a zipper bag and crossed the parking lot and climbed the hotel steps. He registered and got the key and hobbled up the steps and down the hall to his room and went in and locked the door and lay on the bed with the shotgun across his chest, staring at the ceiling. He could think of no reason for the transponder sending unit to be in the hotel. He ruled out Moss because he thought Moss was almost certainly dead. That left the police, or some agent of the Matacumbe Petroleum Group, who must think that he thought that they thought that he thought they were very dumb. He thought about that. When he woke, it was 10:30 at night, and he lay there in the half-dark and the quiet, but he knew what the answer was. He got up and put the shotgun behind the pillows and stuck the pistol into the waistband of his trousers. Then he went out and limped down the stairs to the desk. The clerk was sitting reading a magazine, and when he saw Chigurh, he stuck the magazine under the desk and rose. "Yes, sir," he said.
"I'd like to see the registration."
"Are you a police officer?"
"No, I'm not."
"I'm afraid I can't do that, sir."
"Yes, you can."
When he came back up, he stopped and stood listening in the hallway outside his door. He went in and got the shotgun and the receiver, and then walked down to the room with the tape across it, and held the box to the door and turned it on. He went down to the second door and tried the reception there. Then he came back to the first room and opened the door with the key from the desk and stepped back and stood against the hallway wall. He could hear traffic in the street beyond the parking lot, but still he thought the window was closed. There was no air moving. He looked quickly into the room. Bed pulled away from the wall, bathroom door open. He checked the safety on the shotgun. He stepped across the doorway to the other side. There was no one in the room. He scanned the room with the box and found the sending unit in the drawer of the bedside table. He sat on the bed, turning it in his hand. Small lozenge of burnished metal the size of a domino. He looked out the window at the parking lot. His leg hurt. He put the piece of metal in his pocket and turned off the receiver and rose and left, pulling the door shut behind him. Inside the room, the phone rang. He thought about that for a minute. Then he set the transponder on the windowsill in the hallway and turned and went back down to the lobby. And there he waited for Wells. No one would do that. He sat in a leather armchair, pushed back into the corner, where he could see both the front door and the hallway to the rear. Wells came in at 11:13, and Chigurh rose and followed him up the stairs, the shotgun wrapped loosely in the newspaper he'd been reading. Halfway up the stairs, Wells turned and looked back, and Chigurh let the paper fall and raised the shotgun to his waist.
"Hello, Carson," he said.
They sat in Wells's room, Wells on the bed and Chigurh in the chair by the window.
"You don't have to do this," Wells said. "I'm a day trader. I could just go home." "You could."
"I'd make it worth your while. Take you to an ATM, everybody just walks away. There's about 14 grand in it."
"Good payday."
"I think so." Chigurh looked out the window, the shotgun across his knee.
"Getting hurt changed me," he said. "Changed my perspective. I've moved on, in a way. Some things have fallen into place that were not there before. I thought they were, but they weren't. The best way I can put it is that I've sort of caught up with myself. That's not a bad thing. It was overdue."
"It's still a good payday."
"It is. It's just in the wrong currency."
Wells eyed the distance between them. Senseless. Maybe 20 years ago, probably not even then.
"Do what you have to do," he said.
Chigurh sat slouched casually in the chair, his chin resting against his knuckles, watching Wells, watching his last thoughts. He'd seen it all before. So had Wells.
"It started before that," he said. "I didn't realize it at the time. When I went down to the border, I stopped in a cafe in this town, and there were some men in there drinking beer, and one of them kept looking back at me. I didn't pay any attention to him. I ordered my dinner and ate. But when I walked up to the counter to pay the check, I had to go past them, and they were all grinning, and he said something that was hard to ignore. Do you know what I did?"
"Yeah, I know what you did."
"I ignored him. I paid my bill, and I'd started to push through the door when he said the same thing again. I turned and looked at him. I was just standing there, picking my teeth with a toothpick, and I gave him a little gesture with my head, for him to come outside, if he would like to. And then I went out, and I waited in the parking lot, and he and his friends came out, and I killed him in the parking lot, and then I got into my car. They were all gathered around him. They didn't know what had happened. They didn't know that he was dead. One of them said, 'I'd put a sleeper hold on him,' and then the others all said that. They were trying to get him to sit up. They were slapping him and trying to get him to sit up. An hour later, I was pulled over by a sheriff's deputy outside of Sonora, Texas, and I let him take me into town in handcuffs. I'm not sure why I did this, but I think I wanted to see if I could extricate myself by an act of will, because I believe that one can, that such a thing is possible. But it was a foolish thing to do, a vain thing to do. Do you understand?"
"Do I understand?"
"Yes."
"Do you have any notion of how goddamn crazy you are?
The nature of this conversation.
The nature of you." Chigurh leaned back. He studied Wells.
"Tell me something," he said.
"What?"
"If the rule you followed led you to this, of what use was the rule?"
"I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm talking about your life, in which now everything can be seen at once."
"I'm not interested in your bullshit, Anton."
"I thought you might want to explain yourself."
"I don't have to explain myself to you."
"Not to me. To yourself. I thought you might have something to say."
"You go to hell."
"You surprise me, that's all. I expected something different. It calls past events into question. Don't you think so?"
"You think I trade places with you?"
"Yes, I do. I'm here, and you are there. In a few minutes, I will still be here."
Wells looked out the darkened window. "I know where the satchel is," he said.
"If you knew where the satchel was, you would have it."
"I was going to have to wait until there was no one around, till night, 2 in the morning, something like that."
"You know where the satchel is?"
"Yes."
"I know something better."
"What's that?"
"I know where it's going to be."
"And where is that?"
"It will be brought to me and placed at my feet."
Wells wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. "It wouldn't cost you anything. It's 20 minutes from here."
"You know that's not going to happen, don't you?"
Wells didn't answer.
"Don't you?"
"You go to hell."
"You think you can put it off with your eyes?"
"What do you mean?"
"You think that as long as you keep looking at me, you can put it off?"
"I don't think that."
"Yes, you do. You should admit your situation. There would be more dignity in it. I'm trying to help you."
"You son of a bitch."
"You think you won't close your eyes, but you will."
Wells didn't answer. Chigurh watched him.
"I know what else you think," he said. You don't know what I think. You think I'm like you. That it's just greed, but I'm not like you. I live a simple life. Just do it. You wouldn't understand. A man like you, just do it, yes, Sugar said. They always say that, but they don't mean it, do they? You piece of shit. It's not good, Carson. You need to compose yourself. If you don't respect me, what must you think of yourself? Look at where you are. You think you're outside of everything, Wells said. But you're not. Not everything, no. You're not outside of death. It doesn't mean to me what it does to you. You think I'm afraid to die? Yes. Just do it. Do it and goddamn you. It's not the same, Sugar said. You've been giving up things for years to get here. I don't think I even understood that. How does a man decide in what order to abandon his life? We're in the same line of work, up to a point. Did you hold me in such contempt? Why would you do that? How did you let yourself get in this situation? Wells looked out at the street. What time is it? He said. Sugar raised his wrist and looked at his watch. 11:57, he said. Wells nodded. By the old woman's calendar, I've got 3 more minutes. Well, the hell with it. I think I saw all this coming a long time ago, almost like a dream, deja vu. He looked at Sugar. I'm not interested in your opinions, he said. Just do it, you goddamn psychopath. Do it and goddamn you to hell. He did close his eyes. He closed his eyes and he turned his head and he raised one hand to fend away what could not be fended away. Sugar shot him in the face. Everything that Wells had ever known or thought or loved drained slowly down the wall behind him. His mother's face, his first communion, women he had known, the faces of men as they died on their knees before him, the body of a child dead in a roadside ravine in another country. He lay half headless on the bed with his arms outflung, most of his right hand missing. Sugar rose and picked up the empty casing off the rug and blew into it and put it in his pocket and looked at his watch. The new day was still a minute away. He went down the back stairs and crossed the parking lot to Wells's car and sorted out the door key from the ring of keys Wells carried and opened the door and checked the car, inside, front, and rear, and under the seats. It was a rental car, and there was nothing in it but the rental contract in the door pocket. He shut the door and hobbled back and opened the trunk. Nothing. He went around to the driver's side and opened the door and popped the hood and walked up front and raised the hood and looked in the engine compartment, and then closed the hood and stood looking at the hotel. While he was standing there, Wells's phone rang. He fished the phone from his pocket and pushed the button and put it to his ear. Yes, he said. Moss made his way down the ward and back again, holding on to the nurse's arm. She said encouraging things to him in Spanish. They turned at the end of the bay and started back. The sweat stood on his forehead.
Andale, she said. Que bueno.
He nodded. Damn right, bueno, he said. Late in the night, he woke from a troubling dream and struggled down the hallway and asked to use the telephone. He dialed the number in Odessa and leaned heavily on the counter and listened to it ring. It rang a long time. Finally, her mother answered. It's Llewellyn.
She don't want to talk to you.
Yes, she does.
Do you know what time it is?
I don't care what time it is. Don't you hang up this phone.
I told her what was going to happen, didn't I?
Chapter and verse, I said, this is what will come to pass. And now it has come to pass.
Don't you hang up this phone. You get her and you put her on. When she picked up the phone, she said,
I didn't think you'd do me this away.
Hello, darling. How are you? Are you all right, Llewellyn? What happened to them words?
Where are you?
Piedras Negras.
What am I supposed to do, Llewellyn?
Are you all right?
No, I'm not all right. How would I be all right? People calling here about you? I had the sheriff up here from Terrell County, showed up at the damn door. I thought you was dead.
I ain't dead. What did you tell him?
What could I tell him?
He might con you into saying something.
You're hurt, ain't you?
What makes you say that?
I can hear it in your voice. Are you okay?
I'm okay.
Where are you?
I told you where I was.
You sound like you're in a bus station.
Carla Jean, I think you need to get out of there.
Out of where?
Out of that house.
You're scaring me, Llewellyn. Out of here to go where?
It don't matter. I just don't think you should stay there. You could go to a motel.
And do what with Mama?
She'll be all right.
She'll be all right?
Yes.
You don't know that.
Llewellyn didn't answer.
Do you?
I just don't think anybody will bother her.
You don't think?
You need to get out. Just take her with you.
I can't take my Mama to a motel. She's sick if you ain't forgot.
What did the sheriff say?
Said he was looking for you.
What do you think he said? What else did he say? She didn't answer. Carla Jean? She sounded like she was crying. What else did he say, Carla Jean?
He said you was fixing to get yourself killed.
Well, that's what he would say. She was quiet a long time. Carla Jean?
Llewellyn? I don't even want the money. I just want us to be back like we was.
We will be.
No, we won't. I've thought about it. It's a false god.
Yeah, but it's real money. She said his name again, and then she did begin to cry. He tried to talk to her, but she didn't answer. He stood listening to her sobbing quietly in Odessa. What do you want me to do? He said. She didn't answer. Carla Jean?
I want things to be like they was.
If I tell you I'll try and fix everything, will you do what I ask you?
Yes, I will.
I've got a number here I can call, somebody that can help us.
Can you trust them?
I don't know. I just know I can't trust nobody else. I'll call you tomorrow. I didn't think they'd find you up there, or I never would have sent you. I'll call you tomorrow. He hung up the phone and dialed the mobile number that Wells had given him. It answered on the second ring, but it wasn't Wells. I think I got the wrong number, he said. You don't have the wrong number. You need to come see me. Who is this? You know who it is. Moss leaned on the counter, his forehead against his fist. Where's Wells? He can't help you now. What kind of deal did you cut with him?
I didn't cut any kind of deal.
Yes, you did. How much was he going to give you?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Where's the money? What did you do with Wells? We had a difference of opinion. You don't need to concern yourself about Wells. He's out of the picture. You need to talk to me.
I don't need to talk to you.
I think you do. Do you know where I'm going?
Why would I care where you're going?
Do you know where I'm going?
Moss didn't answer.
Are you there?
I'm here.
I know where you are.
Yeah? Where am I?
You're in a hospital in Piedras Negras. But that's not where I'm going. Do you know where I'm going?
Yeah, I know where you're going.
You can turn all this around.
Why would I believe you?
You believed Wells.
I didn't believe Wells.
You called him.
So, I called him.
Tell me, what do you want me to do?
Moss shifted his weight. Sweat stood on his forehead. He didn't answer.
Tell me something. I'm waiting.
I could be waiting for you when you get there, you know, Moss said.
Charter a plane?
You thought about that?
That would be okay, but you won't.
How do you know I won't?
You wouldn't have told me. Anyway, I have to go.
You know they won't be there.
It doesn't make any difference where they are.
So what are you going up there for?
You know how this is going to turn out, don't you?
No.
Do you?
Yes, I do.
I think you do, too. You just haven't accepted it yet. So this is what I'll do. You bring me the money, and I'll let her walk. Otherwise, she's accountable. The same as you. I don't know if you care about that, but that's the best deal you're going to get. I won't tell you you can save yourself, because you can't.
Well, I'm gonna bring you something, all right, Moss said. I've decided to make you a special project of mine. You ain't gonna have to look for me at all.
I'm glad to hear that.
You are beginning to disappoint me. You won't be disappointed.
Good.
You don't have to, by God, worry about being disappointed.
He left before daylight, dressed in the muslin hospital gown with the overcoat over it. The skirt of the overcoat was stiff with blood. He had no shoes. In the inside pocket of the coat was the money he'd folded away there, stiff and blood-stained. He stood in the street looking toward the lights. He'd no notion where he was. The concrete cold under his feet. He made his way down to the corner. A few cars passed. He walked down to the lights at the next corner and stopped and leaned with one hand against the building. He had two white lozenges in his overcoat pocket that he'd saved, and he took one now, swallowing it dry. He thought he was going to vomit. He stood there for a long time. There was a windowsill there he'd have sat on, save that it was spiked with pointed iron bars to discourage loiterers. A cab went by, and he raised one hand, but it kept going. He was going to have to go out into the street. And after a while, he did. He'd been tottering there for some time when another cab passed, and he raised his hand, and it pulled to the curb. The driver studied him. Moss leaned on the window.
"Can you take me across the bridge?" he said.
"To the other side?"
"Yes, to the other side."
"You got monies?"
"Yes, I got monies."
The driver looked dubious.
$20, he said.
"Okay."
At the gate, the guard leaned down and regarded him where he sat in the dim rear of the cab.
"What country were you born in?" he said.
"The United States."
"What are you bringing in?"
"Not anything."
The guard studied him.
"Would you mind stepping out here?" he said.
Moss pushed down on the door handle and leaned on the front seat to ease himself out of the cab. He stood.
"What happened to your shoes?"
"I don't know."
"You don't have any clothes on, do you?"
"I got clothes on."
The second guard was waving the cars past. He pointed for the cab driver.
"Would you please pull your cab over into the second space there?"
The driver put the cab in gear.
"Would you mind stepping away from the vehicle?"
Moss stepped away. The cab pulled into the parking area, and the driver cut the engine. Moss looked at the guard. The guard seemed to be waiting for him to say something, but he didn't. They took him inside and sat him in a steel chair in a small white office. Another man came in and stood leaning against a steel desk. He looked him over.
"How much have you had to drink?"
I ain't had anything to drink. What happened to you?
What do you mean?
What happened to your clothes?
I don't know. Do you have any identification?
No.
Nothing?
No.
The man leaned back, his arms crossed at his chest. He said,
"Who do you think gets to go through this gate into the United States of America?"
I don't know. American citizens? Some American citizens?
Who do you think decides that?
You do, I reckon.
That's correct.
And how do I decide?
I don't know. I ask questions. If I get sensible answers, then they get to go to America. If I don't get sensible answers, they don't.
Is there anything about that that you don't understand?
No, sir.
Then maybe you'd like to start over.
All right.
We need to hear more about why you're out here with no clothes on.
I got a overcoat on. Are you jacking with me?
No, sir. Don't jack with me.
Are you in the service?
No, sir. I'm a veteran.
What branch of the service?
United States Army.
Were you in NAM?
Yes, sir. 3 tours.
What outfit?
12th Infantry Battalion.
What were your dates of tour duty?
August 7th, 1966 to May 2nd, 1968.
The man watched him for some time. Moss looked at him and looked away. He looked toward the door, the empty hall, sitting hunched forward in the overcoat with his elbows on his knees.
Are you all right?
Yes, sir, I'm all right.
I got a wife that'll come and get me if you all will let me go on.
Have you got any money?
You got change for a phone call?
Yes, sir.
He heard claws scrabbling on the tiles. A guard was standing there with a German shepherd on a lead. The man jutted his chin at the guard.
Get someone to help this man. He needs to get into town. Is the taxi gone?
Yes, sir. It was clean.
I know.
Get someone to help him.
He looked at Moss.
Where are you from?
I'm from San Saba, Texas.
Does your wife know where you are?
Yes, sir. I talked to her here just a while ago.
Did you all have a fight?
Did who have a fight?
You and your wife.
Well, somewhat of a one, I reckon, yes, sir.
You need to tell her you're sorry.
Sir?
I said you need to tell her you're sorry.
Yes, sir, I will.
Even if you think it was her fault.
Yes, sir.
Go on, get your ass out of here.
Yes, sir.
Sometimes you have a little problem and you don't fix it, and then all of a sudden it ain't a little problem anymore. You understand what I'm telling you?
Yes, sir, I do.
Go on.
Yes, sir.
It was almost daylight and the cab was long gone. He set out up the street. A bloody serum was leaking from his wound and it was running down the inside of his leg. People paid him little mind. He turned up Adams Street and stopped at a clothing store and peered in. Lights were on at the rear. He knocked at the door and waited and knocked again. Finally, a small man in a white shirt and a black tie opened the door and looked out at him.
"I know you ain't open," Moss said, "but I need some clothes real bad."
The man nodded and swung open the door.
"Come in," he said.
They walked side by side down the aisle toward the boot section. Tony Lama, Justin, Nakona. There were some low chairs there, and Moss eased himself down and sat with his hands gripping the chair arms.
"I need boots and some clothes," he said. "I got some medical problems, and I don't want to walk around no more than what I can help."
The man nodded.
"Yes, sir," he said. "Of course." "Do you carry the Larry Mahans?"
"No, sir, we don't."
"That's all right. I need a pair of Wrangler jeans, 32 by 34 length, a shirt size large, some socks, and show me some Nakona boots in a 10.5, and I need a belt."
"Yes, sir. Did you want to look at hats?"
Moss looked across the store.
"I think a hat would be good. You got any of them stockman's hats with a small brim, 7 3/8?
Yes, we do. We have a 3X Beaver in the Resistol and a little better grade in the Stetson, a 5X, I think it is.
Let me see the Stetson, that silver belly color.
All right, sir. Are white socks all right?
White socks is all I wear.
What about underwear?
Maybe a pair of jockey shorts, 32 or medium.
Yes, sir. You just make yourself comfortable. Are you all right?
I'm all right. The man nodded and turned to go. Can I ask you something? Moss said.
Yes, sir.
Do you get a lot of people come in here with no clothes on?
No, sir, I wouldn't say a lot.
He carried the pile of new clothing with him to the dressing room and slid off the coat and hung it from the hook on the back of the door. A pale, dried blood was crusted across his sallow, sunken paunch. He pushed at the edges of the tape, but they wouldn't stick. He eased himself down on the wooden bench and pulled on the socks, and he opened the package of shorts and took them out and pulled them over his feet and up to his knees, and then stood and pulled them carefully up over the dressing. He sat again and undid the shirt from its cardboard forms and endless pins. When he came out of the dressing room, he had the coat over his arm. He walked up and down the creaking wooden aisle. The clerk stood looking down at the boots.
"The lizard takes longer to break in," he said.
"Yeah. Hot in the summer, too. These are all right. Let's try that hat. I ain't been duded up like this since I got out of the army."
The sheriff sipped his coffee and set the cup back down in the same ring on the glass desktop that he'd taken it from.
"They're fixing to close the hotel," he said.
Bell nodded.
"I ain't surprised. They all quit? That feller hadn't pulled but two shifts. I blame myself. Never occurred to me that son of a bitch would come back. I just never even imagined such a thing. He might never have left. I thought about that, too. The reason nobody knows what he looks like is that they don't none of them live long enough to tell it. This is a goddamn homicidal lunatic, Ed Tom. Yeah, I don't think he's a lunatic, though. Well, what would you call him? I don't know. When are they fixing to close it? It's done closed as far as that goes. You got a key? Yeah, I got a key. It's a crime scene. Why don't we go over there and look around some more? All right, we can do that.
The first thing they saw was the transponder unit sitting on a windowsill in the hallway. Bell picked it up and turned it in his hand, looking at the dial and the knobs.
That ain't a goddamn bomb, is it, Sheriff? No. That's all we need. It's a tracking device. So whatever it was they was tracking, they found. Probably. How long has it been sitting there, do you reckon? I don't know. I think I might be able to guess what they were tracking, though. Maybe, Bell said. There's something about this whole deal that don't rattle right. It ain't supposed to. We got an ex-army colonel here with most of his head gone that you had to ID off of his fingerprints, what fingers wasn't shot off. Regular army, 24 years service. Not a piece of paper on him. He'd been robbed. Yeah. What do you know about this that you ain't telling, Sheriff? You got the same facts I got. I ain't talking about facts. You think this whole mess has moved south? Bell shook his head. I don't know. You got a dog in this hunt? Not really. A couple of kids from my county that might be sort of involved that ought not to be. Sort of involved? Yeah. Are we talking kin? No. Just people from my county. People I'm supposed to be looking after.
He handed the transponder unit to the sheriff.
What am I supposed to do with this? It's Maverick County property, crime scene evidence.
The sheriff shook his head. Dope, he said.
Dope. They sell that shit to school kids. It's worse than that. How's that? School kids buy it.
Part 7.
I won't talk about the war, neither. I was supposed to be a war hero, and I lost a whole squad of men, got decorated for it. They died and I got a medal. I don't even need to know what you think about that. There ain't a day I don't remember it. Some boys I know come back. They went on to school up at Austin on the GI Bill. They had hard things to say about their people. Some of them did. Called them a bunch of rednecks and all such as that. Didn't like their politics. 2 generations in this county is a long time. You're talking about the early settlers. I used to tell them that having your wife and children killed and scalped and gutted like fish has a tendency to make some people irritable, but they didn't seem to know what I was talking about. I think the 60s in this country sobered some of them up. I hope it did. I read in the papers here a while back, some teachers come across a survey that was sent out back in the 30s to a number of schools around the country. Had this questionnaire about what was the problems with teaching in the schools, and they come across these forms. They'd been filled out and sent in from around the country answering these questions. And the biggest problems they could name was things like talking in class and running in the hallways, chewing gum, copying homework, things of that nature. So they got one of them forms that was blank and printed up a bunch of them and sent them back out to the same schools 40 years later. Well, here come the answers back. Rape, arson, murder, drugs, suicide. So I think about that. Because a lot of the time, ever when I say anything about how the world is going to hell in a handbasket, people will just sort of smile and tell me I'm getting old, that it's one of the symptoms. But my feeling about that is that anybody that can't tell the difference between raping and murdering people and chewing gum has got a whole lot bigger of a problem than what I've got. And 40 years is not a long time, neither. Maybe the next 40 of it will bring some of them out from under the ether, if it ain't too late. Here, a year or two back, me and Loretta went to a conference in Corpus Christi, and I got set next to this woman. She was the wife of somebody or other, and she kept talking about the right wing this and the right wing that. I ain't even sure what she meant by it. The people I know are mostly just common people. Common as dirt, as the saying goes. I told her that, and she looked at me funny. She thought I was saying something bad about them, but of course that's a high compliment in my part of the world. She kept on, kept on. Finally told me, said, "I don't like the way this country is headed. I want my granddaughter to be able to have an abortion." And I said, "Well, ma'am, I don't think you got any worries about the way the country's headed. The way I see it going, I don't have much doubt that what she'll be able to have an abortion. I'm going to say that not only will she be able to have an abortion, she'll be able to have you put to sleep." Which pretty much ended the conversation.
Chigurh limped up the 17 flights of concrete steps in the cool concrete well. And when he got to the steel door on the landing, he shot the cylinder out of the lock with the plunger of the stun gun and opened the door and stepped into the hallway and shut the door behind him. He stood leaning against the door with the shotgun in both hands, listening, breathing no harder than if he'd just got up out of a chair. He went back down the hallway and picked the crushed cylinder out of the floor and put it in his pocket and went on to the elevator and stood listening again. He took off his boots and stood them by the elevator door and went down the hallway in his sock feet, walking slowly, favoring his wounded leg. The doors to the office were open onto the hallway. He stopped. He thought that perhaps the man didn't see his own shadow on the outer hallway wall, ill-defined, but there. Chigurh thought it an odd oversight, but he knew that fear of an enemy can often blind men to other hazards, not least the shape which they themselves make in the world. He slipped the strap from his shoulder and lowered the air tank to the floor. He studied the stance of the man's shadow, framed there by the light from the smoked glass window behind him. He pushed the shotgun's follower slightly back with the heel of his hand to check the chambered round and pushed the safety off. The man was holding a small pistol at the level of his belt. Sugar stepped into the doorway and shot him in the throat with a load of number 10 shot, the size collectors use to take bird specimens. The man fell back through his swivel chair, knocking it over, and went to the floor and lay there, twitching and gurgling. Sugar picked up the smoking shotgun shell from the carpet and put it in his pocket and walked into the room with the pale smoke still drifting from the canister fitted to the end of the sawed-off barrel. He walked around behind the desk and stood looking down at the man. The man was lying on his back, and he had one hand over his throat, but the blood was pumping steadily through his fingers and out onto the rug. His face was full of small holes, but his right eye seemed intact, and he looked up at Sugar and tried to speak from out of his bubbling mouth. Sugar dropped to one knee and leaned on the shotgun and looked at him.
"What is it?" he said. "What are you trying to tell me?"
The man moved his head. The blood gurgled in his throat.
"Can you hear me?"
Sugar said. He didn't answer.
"I'm the man you sent Carson Wells to kill. Is that what you wanted to know?"
He watched him. He was wearing a blue nylon running suit and a pair of white leather shoes. Blood was starting to pool about his head, and he was shivering as if he were cold.
"The reason I used the bird shot was that I didn't want to break the glass behind you, to rain glass on people in the street."
He nodded toward the window where the man's upper silhouette stood outlined in the small gray pockmarks the lead had left in the glass. He looked at the man. The man's hand had gone slack at his throat, and the blood had slowed. He looked at the pistol lying there. He rose and pushed the safety back on the shotgun and stepped past the man to the window and inspected the pockings the lead had made. When he looked down at the man again, the man was dead. He crossed the room and stood at the doorway, listening. He went out and down the hall and collected his tank and the stun gun and got his boots and stepped into them and pulled them up. Then he walked down the corridor and went out through the metal door and down the concrete steps to the garage, where he'd left his vehicle. When they got to the bus station, it was just breaking daylight, gray and cold and a light rain falling. She leaned forward over the seat and paid the driver and gave him a $2 tip. He got out and went around to the trunk and opened it and got their bags and set them in the portico and brought the walker around to her mother's side and opened the door. Her mother turned and began to struggle out into the rain.
"Mama, will you wait? I need to get around there." "I knowed this is what it would come to," the mother said. "I said it 3 years ago." "It ain't been 3 years. I used them very words. Just wait till I get around there." "In the rain," her mother said.
She looked up at the cab driver.
"I got cancer," she said. "Now look at this. Not even a home to go to."
"Yes, ma'am."
"We're going to El Paso, Texas. You know how many people I know in El Paso, Texas?"
"No, ma'am." She paused with her arm on the door and held up her hand and made an O with her thumb and forefinger.
"That's how many," she said.
"Yes, ma'am." They sat in the coffee shop, surrounded by their bags and parcels, and stared out at the rain and at the idling buses, at the gray day breaking. She looked at her mother.
"Did you want some more coffee?" she said.
The old woman didn't answer.
"You ain't speaking, I reckon. I don't know what there is to speak about." "Well, I don't guess I do either. Whatever y'all done, you done. I don't know why I ought to have to run from the law." "We ain't running from the law, Mama." "You couldn't call on them to help you, though, could you?"
"Call on who?"
"The law." "No, we couldn't. That's what I thought."
The old woman adjusted her teeth with her thumb and stared out the window. After a while, the bus came. The driver stowed her walker in the luggage bay under the bus, and they helped her up the steps and put her in the first seat.
"I got cancer," she told the driver.
Carla Jean put their bags in the bin overhead and sat down. The old woman didn't look at her.
3 years ago, she said, you didn't have to have no dream about it, no revelation nor nothing. I don't give myself no credit. Anybody could have told you the same thing.
Well, I wasn't asking. The old woman shook her head, looking out through the window and down at the table they'd vacated.
I give myself no credit, she said. I'd be the last in the world to do that.
Shiger pulled up across the street and shut off the engine. He turned off the lights and sat watching the darkened house. The green diode numerals on the radio put the time at 1:17. He sat there till 1:22, and then he took the flashlight from the glove box and got out and closed the truck door and crossed the street to the house. He opened the screen door and punched out the cylinder and walked in and shut the door behind him and stood listening. There was a light coming from the kitchen, and he walked down the hallway with the flashlight in one hand and the shotgun in the other. When he got to the doorway, he stopped and listened again. The light came from a bare bulb on the back porch. He went on into the kitchen. A bare formica and chrome table in the center of the room with a box of cereal standing on it. The shadow of the kitchen window lying on the linoleum floor. He crossed the room and opened the refrigerator and looked in. He put the shotgun in the crook of his arm and took out a can of orange soda and opened it with his forefinger and stood drinking it, listening for anything that might follow the metallic click of the can. He drank and set the half-empty can on the counter and shut the refrigerator door and walked through the dining room and into the living room and sat in an easy chair in the corner and looked out at the street. After a while, he rose and crossed the room and went up the stairs. He stood listening at the head of the stairwell. When he entered the old woman's room, he could smell the sweet, musty odor of sickness, and he thought for a moment she might even be lying there in the bed. He switched on the flashlight and went into the bathroom. He stood reading the labels of the pharmacy bottles on the vanity. He looked out the window at the street below, the dull winter light from the street lamps. 2 in the morning, dry, cold, silent. He went out and down the hallway to the small bedroom at the rear of the house. He emptied her bureau drawers out onto the bed and sat sorting through her things, holding up from time to time some item and studying it in the bluish light from the yard lamp. A plastic hairbrush, a cheap fairground bracelet. Weighing these things in his hand like a medium who might thereby divine some fact concerning the owner. He sat turning the pages in a photo album. School friends, family, a dog, a house, not this one, a man who may have been her father. He put 2 pictures of her in his shirt pocket. There was a ceiling fan overhead. He got up and pulled the chain and lay down on the bed with a shotgun alongside him, watching the wooden blades wheel slowly in the light from the window. After a while, he got up and took the chair from the desk in the corner and tilted it and pushed the top back ladder up under the doorknob. Then he sat on the bed and pulled off his boots and stretched out and went to sleep. In the morning, he walked through the house again upstairs and down and then returned to the bathroom at the end of the hall to shower. He left the curtain pulled back, the water spraying onto the floor. The hallway door open and the shotgun lying on the vanity a foot away. He dried the dressing on his leg with a hair dryer and shaved and dressed and went down to the kitchen and ate a bowl of cereal and milk, walking through the house as he ate. In the living room he stopped and looked at the mail lying in the floor beneath the brass slot in the front door. He stood there, chewing slowly. Then he set the bowl and spoon on the coffee table and crossed the room and bent over and picked up the mail and stood sorting through it. He sat in a chair by the door and opened the phone bill and cupped the envelope and blew into it. He glanced down the list of calls. Halfway down was the Terrell County Sheriff's Department. He folded the bill and put it back in the envelope and put the envelope in his shirt pocket. Then he looked through the other pieces of mail again. He rose and went into the kitchen and got the shotgun off the table and came back and stood where he'd stood before. He crossed to a cheap mahogany desk and opened the top drawer. The drawer was stuffed with mail. He laid the shotgun down and sat in the chair and pulled the mail out and piled it on the desk and began to go through it. Moss spent the day in a cheap motel on the edge of town, sleeping naked in the bed with his new clothes on wire hangers in the closet. When he woke, the shadows were long in the motel courtyard, and he struggled up and sat on the edge of the bed, a pale bloodstain the size of his hand on the sheets. There was a paper bag on the night table that held things he'd bought from a drugstore in town, and he picked it up and limped into the bathroom. He showered and shaved and brushed his teeth for the first time in 5 days, and then sat on the edge of the tub and taped fresh gauze over his wounds. Then he got dressed and called a cab. He was standing in front of the motel office when the cab pulled up. He climbed into the rear seat, got his breath, then reached and shut the door. He regarded the face of the driver in the rearview mirror. "Do you want to make some money?" he said. "Yeah, I want to make some money." Moss took 5 of the hundreds and tore them in 2 and passed 1/2 across the back of the seat to the driver. The driver counted the torn bills and put them in his shirt pocket and looked at Moss in the mirror and waited. "What's your name?"
"Paul," said the driver.
"You got the right attitude, Paul. I won't get you in trouble. I just don't want you to leave me somewheres that I don't want to be left."
"All right."
"Have you got a flashlight?"
"Yeah, I got a flashlight."
"Let me have it."
The driver passed the flashlight to the back.
"You're the man," Moss said.
"Where are we going?"
"Down the river road."
"I ain't picking nobody up."
"We're not picking anybody up."
The driver watched him in the mirror.
"No drogas," he said. "No drogas."
The driver waited.
"I'm going to pick up a briefcase. It belongs to me. You can look inside if you want. Nothing illegal."
"I can look inside."
"Yes, you can."
"I hope you're not jerking me around."
"No."
"I like money, but I like staying out of jail even better."
"I'm the same way myself," Moss said.
They drove slowly up the road toward the bridge. Moss leaned forward over the seat.
"I want you to park under the bridge," he said.
"All right."
"I'm going to unscrew the bulb out of this dome light."
"They watch this road round the clock,"
the driver said.
"I know that."
The driver pulled off the road and shut off the engine and the lights and looked at Moss in the mirror. Moss took the bulb from the light and laid it in the plastic lens and handed it across the seat to the driver and opened the door.
"I should be back in just a few minutes," he said.
The cane was dusty, the stalks close-grown. He pushed his way through carefully, holding the light at his knees with his hand partly across the lens. The case was sitting in the brake, right side up and intact as if someone had simply set it there. He switched off the light and picked it up and made his way back in the dark, taking his sight by the span of the bridge overhead. When he got to the cab, he opened the door and set the case in the seat and got in carefully and shut the door. He handed the flashlight to the driver and leaned back in the seat.
"Let's go," he said.
"What's in there?"
the driver said.
"Money."
"Money?"
"Money."
The driver started the engine and pulled out onto the road.
"Turn your lights on," Moss said. He turned the lights on.
"How much money?"
"A lot of money."
"What will you take to drive me to San Antonio?"
The driver thought about it.
"You mean on top of the 500?
"Yes."
"How about a grand all in?"
"Everything."
"Yes."
"You got it."
The driver nodded.
"Then how about the other half of these 5 Caesars I already got?"
Moss took the bills from his pocket and handed them across the back of the seat.
"What if the Migra stop us?"
"They won't stop us," Moss said.
"How do you know?" "There's too much shit still down the road that I got to deal with. It ain't gonna end here. I hope you're right. Trust me, Moss said. I hate hearing them words, the driver said. I always did. Have you ever said them? Yeah, I've said them. That's how come I know what they're worth.
He spent the night in a roadway inn on Highway 90, just west of town, and in the morning he went down and got a paper and climbed laboriously